You and I back together again Tuesday, June 8th, 2021, right here on Connecticut Today. As we conducted the show, plenty of reaction was rolling in after an overnight vote, 19-17, in the state Senate to move a bill legalizing recreational marijuana for adults 21 and over. That bill moving on to the state House. One of the no votes in the Senate joined us, Republican State Senate member Eric Berthel. 5 o'clock hour, we talked to a person who's edited a new book of essays that claims that racial discrimination is still going on U.S. college campuses when it should have been outlawed, or at least we thought that, and the group getting hit hardest, students of Asian descent. Someone who participated in the state Senate debate in the wee hours, as usually happens here in Connecticut. He was a no vote on this. Republican Eric Berthel, District 32, portions thereof of Watertown, Woodbury, Southbury, Washington, Bridgewater, and more. Eric, hi, it's Paul again. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. How are you? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Eric. Talk about the debate a little bit before you, cast your no vote. Was this a serious debate, Eric? Did the vote total in the end surprise you? Let my listeners know what went on here.
Yeah, sure. It's definitely a serious debate. We're talking about taking a Class 1 narcotic, and that's illegal at the federal level, and making it legal for sale and consumption in Connecticut. So it's a very serious piece of legislation. I think the no votes were rooted somewhat more, Paul, in some of the other components of the bill, more so than the actual legalization aspect. You know, I've been a no vote since this discussion began 7 years ago when I first came up here into the House. But my concerns are rooted more in what else is in that bill. You know, I'm certainly a proponent. If we are going to legalize recreational use, I want to make sure that we're doing it as safely and as properly as we can, that we have regulated growers, we have good regulations to make sure that the products that consumers will be buying are safe. I think that's probably a part of this bill that every single person in this room, in this building could vote yes on. The other components of the bill with respect to the revenue grab, with respect to even some of the equity pieces that are in it are, to me, a little bit overthought and seem unfair, to be honest with you. I think we rushed to get something done this session. And, you know, the vote was very close in the Senate. It was 19-17 with 11 Republicans out of 12 saying no, and another, six voting Democrats voting no with the Republicans. So it's an interesting day. I don't know, and I won't predict what's going to happen in the House. I think it will also be a very close vote down there. It's a much bigger group, as you know. There's 151 legislators downstairs with a lot of opinions. We talked that bill until almost 2 o'clock this morning.
Oh God!
I suspect when the House, it was a late ride home for everyone. I suspect when the House takes up that legislation, whether that's today or tomorrow, you know, we finish tomorrow night at midnight. That's legally when we have to end the regular session. I think the House can go really long on this, and they should. It's worthy of a very, very complex, long debate with a lot of questions being asked and answered.
You know, Eric, I agree with a lot of what you said, in particular the what we're doing here. Okay, the grand goal is to say, listen, adults who want to use this safely without operating a motor vehicle, without giving it to minors, I think there's all a streak, Eric, of libertarian in us that says, okay,
sure,
do that, whatever.
Sure.
But it's the other stuff, Eric, and the thing that, I don't want to say rubs me the wrong way, but I said earlier in the show, there's kind of a disconnect here. It's being sold, Eric, almost as kind of a reparations bill. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I understand the policing was different back then. And, you know, I used to work at radio stations where we had reporters who would go out and interview drug dealers and say, yeah, most of my customers are white suburbanites. We get that. But I think, Eric, there's an uneasiness by, frankly, a lot of people in the suburbs are saying, okay, if this is going to be legal all around the state, is all this money just going to go to Hartford, Waterbury, New Haven, or Bridgeport? You know what I mean?
Well, you're exactly right. And that was a big part of the debate that ensued in the Senate chamber. And it's part of the conversation that's occurring in all of the districts. Anyone who's paying attention to this is having the same kind of, you know, what if moments, if you will, or, you know, and not what if, but kind of a, you know, what are we doing moments is what I mean to say. Like, you know, it does have a little bit of that flavor to it. And, you know, when we are looking at legislation today, and look, I think that we all understand that there are equity issues that we have dealt with already that we should continue to look at. This bill seems to push that envelope a little bit too far, in my opinion, in terms of exactly what you just said. You know, the money that should be coming into that program, particularly, Paul, when hours before this debate, we passed the bill regarding opioid abuse and getting therapy, and then we have a bill that we may hear to ban flavored cigarettes and flavored tobacco, yet we gleefully passed this bill to legalize recreational marijuana, which will include edibles and flavored pot and, you know, vanilla sunrise and whatever the flavors are, right? There's a lot of hypocrisy. And then when you look further into the bill, and it's 297 pages, and you see all of this money or a large part of this money being directed into communities where there are equity issues, it really gives you reason to pause, quite honestly. And again, I'm all for if we have to have recreational use, I want to make sure it's safe. And that's why, you know, we can't pick the parts of the bill that we vote for. We have to vote for the whole thing or nothing, right? We have to say yes or no to the whole bill. The parts of the bill that ensure safety and quality of the product, whether or not I agree with whether or not we should have recreational use is not the issue. And if we have to have it, and I think we will at the end of the debate, at least there's a part of the bill that makes sure that we're going to do it safely. We're going to protect the public to the extent, you know, the public safety to the extent that we can, because that's a really important part of it. Colorado screwed this up really bad back in 2012, and they're still trying to fix it. So I think that part of the bill we got right, but there's other things that anyone who's curious can go look at this bill. It's 300, almost 300 pages of lots of interesting components, and
for a little light post dinner reading is what you're telling me.
A little light post dinner reading. Yeah.
And I would recommend all the folks, our kind listeners, Eric, if they have a lawyer in the family, they may want to have that lawyer with them as they paw through this. You know, Eric, you're right. I think part of the problem is as we see in the federal government with the infrastructure and budget, there are these huge omnibus bills that are put forward. So, you know, in theory, I'm for infrastructure, but is this for infrastructure? As you just said, in theory, it's time we look at marijuana differently, but there are all these components. And Eric, I know a big component is law enforcement. And I have, law enforcement officers in my family who say, hey, alcohol is fine. Listen, I have a breathalyzer in my patrol car, then we can do a blood test at a hospital. There's a lot of concern, Eric, that I've heard from law enforcement people who are afraid they're going to have to make kind of a subjective call on a pot-induced DUI, as they do now.
Yeah, so Paul, two things on that. When Colorado did this 10 years ago, it took something like, if I remember correctly, and don't quote me, you know, it might have been 64, it might have been 60, but it took 60 some odd amendments to their DUI statutes to get something that was actually meaningful and enforceable in terms of what they could actually stop someone for, short of a, you know, a Cheech and Chong stop where they, you know, you roll down the windows and there's smoke billowing out of the windows, right? But more significantly, you know, we also went through a big police reform bill, as you recall. You spoke with some of my colleagues about that last summer. And we've taken away some authority for our police to act with respect to any kind of motor vehicle stop. So it's very interesting. It's going to be very difficult. I think we're going to end up with some difficult lawsuits as we deal with people who will drive under the influence of marijuana going forward. In every state where marijuana has been legalized, they've seen a huge uptick in motor vehicle accidents that ultimately have been related to the use of cannabis. I mean, up significantly, hundreds of percent up from what the existing accident rate was, and attributable to people driving under the influence. So I hope that we will do perhaps a better job with explaining and enforcing the law in terms of people who might choose to drive under the influence of cannabis. But time will tell. And we have a little bit of time. You know, most of the components of this bill, the recreational products, are not available for, I believe, until next year, next July.
Mm-hmm.
We've decriminalized possession right now. That's the thing that happens right away. We've decriminalized larger amounts of marijuana that you may have in your possession. So it's an interesting piece of legislation. Again, it's a lot to read, but anyone who's really concerned about this, instead of just taking a side that you're for or against, go and read it. Talk to your legislator. Call their office. Call your senator, your state rep. Have them explain it to you. Have them go through it with you if you're so inclined. It's a big change for Connecticut. It's going to fundamentally change recreational behavior in our state. And it did deserve a long debate. I hope it gets an even longer debate in the House of Representatives when they finally call it.
Eric, thank you. Eric Berthel, Republican State Senate member, a no vote on recreational pot, District 32. Eric, thanks. We'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. All right. Our next guest joins us. She is a professor of law at the University of San Diego and also a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She sits on the board of directors of the American Civil Rights Project, Californians for Equal Rights, the National Association of Scholars, and other bodies as well. She has gotten together with a co-editor here to bring us a dubious expediency, how race preferences damage higher education. And apparently this stuff is still going on. Gail Harriet joins us here on WICC. Hey, Gail, it's Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. First, Gail, before we get into the book that you and your co-editor put together, these essays, talk about, because we've heard this about this body so much, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. What does it actually do, the body you sit on there?
Well, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights was started back in 1957, and what it does is it issues reports on various civil rights issues in order to better inform the President and Congress and the American people on the state of civil rights. They are especially, you know, required by Congress to do at least one report per year on how well the federal government is enforcing a particular part of civil rights law.
Now, you've got together with Maimon Schwarzschild here to put this collection of essays together, A Dubious Expediency, How Race Preferences Damage Higher Education. Now, Gail, forgive me if I'm wrong here, but I thought the racial preference thing was done on college campuses. Am I wrong, or do we just not know what's going on here?
Oh, diversity preferences now are very much the norm.
Mm-hmm.
At just about every selective college or university, law school or medical school in the country, it's the standards that are applied are very different depending upon what race the applicant happens to be. If you're Asian American, you have to be that much better than everybody else. If you're African American, your academic credentials can be much lower, and you'll still get in. And that has been going on now for many decades. The Supreme Court has not done much to stop that. And, you know, unless the Supreme Court does something soon, it's going to keep going forever and ever.
And I know, Gail, there has been rumblings now in the news over the past few months or year or so, and now it's kind of been magnified with everybody concerned about abuse of Asian race people, Asian Americans, because of COVID. I did read a fascinating essay the other day from an Asian American advocate who said, well, forget COVID for the time being. We are being systematically discriminated against by keeping us out of a lot of major universities for which, at least academically, we are eminently qualified.
Exactly. Right now, there is a lawsuit that is pending before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has not decided whether or not to take the lawsuit yet. As you probably know, the Supreme Court gets to pick and choose which cases they're going to decide. And this case is called Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard. And it is all about the fact that Asian American students have a tougher time. Their academic credentials do have to be that much better. It's very much like the old Jewish quotas that the Ivy League had back in the 1920s and for decades after that as well, where if you were Jewish, your academic credentials had to be better than anybody else's in order to get in.
And I know, Gail, there have been some lower-level decisions here in some schools saying, well, academics is one thing, but a certain race or category of people may have had advantages that other people didn't have. And, of course, part of the educational experience is diversity. That all sounds good unless you're a parent of or one of the people who loses out at getting into your dream school.
That's exactly right. But, you know, it's not just a matter of race, too. I mean, if really colleges and universities were concerned with who is disadvantaged, they'd give preferences on that basis. But you can be a minority student, an African-American student, whose parents are a couple of brain surgeons, and they still will give you preferential treatment. Here in California, where I live, we have actually an amendment to our Constitution put there in 1996, Proposition 209, that forbids racial preferences in college admissions and also in other things like public contracting. And, you know, the argument that was being made last year when there was a campaign to repeal Proposition 209 was that, you know, we need diversity, we need to care about disadvantage. But I think the proper response to that is if a college or university, you know, wants to give a little leg up to somebody who's actually, you know, poor, maybe their parents didn't graduate from high school or didn't go to college or, you know, they have been poor. You know, that's one thing. But to decide who is advantaged or disadvantaged based on skin color, that's quite another thing. And I think that's contrary to our principles as Americans that race discrimination is wrong.
Well, exactly, Gail Harriet. Why? I mean, what is the fear here? Is it just from the Twitter mobs? Is there no school that says, you know what? The best and the brightest come to this school. Frankly, we don't care about skin color. If you're good enough to get in and the financials work out and you score well, you're getting in. What's the fear?
Colleges and universities have a different way of looking at it. I honestly, you know, I've been on campus here for 30 years, and I've never heard someone explain to me exactly why they've dug themselves into this situation, but they have. The race preferences that are given on campuses are really, you know, these are not just a thumb on the scale in an otherwise closed case. They're pretty strong preferences. And what's happened is that every school gets committed because all the other schools are committed. Mm-hmm. So if the top school, you know, isn't satisfied with the number of underrepresented minority students that they have and they start giving a preference, well, the school that's one rung down, you know, they've now lost the students that they would have gotten, the minority students they would have gotten, because they've gone to the school that's just a little bit higher on the pecking order. So they now turn around and do the same thing. And the school that's third, you know, in the pecking order has now lost its minority students that would have otherwise come there, and they reach down into the pool.
Oh,
and they all think that, like, gosh, we have to do this or we wouldn't get any minority students. But it's not true. If every school worked on a race-neutral basis, you know, there'd be somewhat fewer underrepresented minority students at the very, very, very top schools. But there'd be plenty. There are plenty of talented minority students. There'd be plenty in other schools. You know, and the sad part of it is that we'd actually have more African-American physicians, more African-American engineers, scientists, if students were going to the school where their academic credentials put them in the ballpark with other students.
Interesting. So in other words, what's the point of trying to jam somebody into this super elite? That's like sending me to MIT. Forget it. I would pass out in a day, but I might be able to actually get a degree somewhere else where I'm not a brainiac, but I've got that sheepskin and I can do what I want to do.
And you could still be, you know, an engineer or a scientist. It's not just brainiacs. You know, when I was in high school, I considered myself really good at math, you know, really good at science, but not MIT caliber. And you put a student who's good and perfectly capable of being a physician, being an engineer, being a scientist, but you put him in the wrong school, And, you know, that ambition withers and dies because they're going to be outcompeted. And there are now three, count them, three empirical studies showing that in the area of math and science and engineering, that we actually have more African-American scientists, engineers, you know, more of them getting out of college with a degree in science and engineering if only schools used race-neutral admissions policies.
Interesting. And yet some of those schools, the upper schools, you know, it's a trophy thing. Hey, look who we have here. It's pretty sad. Gail Harriet is the co-editor of a book of essays, A Dubious Expediency, How Race Preferences Damage Higher Education. Gail, thank you. It's been fascinating. Good luck with the essay collection, and hopefully we can talk down the road. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Gail Harriet, folks, H-E-R-I-O-T, A Dubious Expediency, How Race Preferences Damage Higher Education. It's a collection of essays, author, college professor, and a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. How about that? She said there are studies out there that if you just let minority students go to the schools they can get into, there are better outcomes. You turn out more, you know, minority doctors and engineers and physicists. But again, we have this soft kind of bigotry of saying, well, no, you've got to come to our school.